The oil we were shown at Sleepy Bay spilled into Prince William Sound March 24, 1989, just after midnight when the Exxon Valdez, a ship the size of three football fields, ran aground on a reef, even though the reef was plainly marked on charts in the wheelhouse. Eventually, oil from the tanker's ruptured hull spread over 1,300 miles of Alaskan coastline. The death toll was staggering. A quarter of a million seabirds, 3,000 otters, hundreds of bald eagles. And despite Exxon's attempts to clean up the mess, government scientists say oil from the spill continues to take a toll on marine life in Prince William Sound.
Everybody, my name is Shauna, and this is the American English Podcast. My goal here is to teach you the English spoken in the United States through common expressions, pronunciation tips, and interesting cultural snippets or stories. I hope to keep this fun, useful, and interesting. Let's do it. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. In that introduction, you heard a speaker from 60 Minutes talk about the Exxon Valdez spill and also about the impact it made on the environment 10 years after the catastrophe took place. If you want to access that, you will find the link within the transcript. In today's episode, we'll also talk about oil spills off the coast of the United States, two of the other biggest ones in history, actually. But before we get to that, let's go through a joke. We'll talk about the expression spill the beans, which is an expression I love in English that's also very common, and do some pronunciation drills. So stay tuned. Let's go ahead and start with that joke. And this one I'm going to need to explain, so I'm sure none of you will laugh when listening to this for the first time, but that's okay. The wordplay here is great. What do you call the victim of an urban oil spill? Any ideas? A city slicker. All right. So as I said, simple wordplay here. A city slicker is the term we use to refer to someone who lives in the city. It's oftentimes someone who doesn't understand what it's like to live outside of the city. So after living in New York City for a while, when I came back home, my uncle greeted me and said, "Hey there, you city slicker. Come in to visit us country folk." Right? So as you can see, your city slicker would be the joking term to call someone from a city, and then country folk is, of course, someone from the countryside, right? So in a slick is a layer of oil on top of water. When there is an oil spill, when oil is accidentally poured into the ocean, boats need to skim the water to clean up the slick, that thick or thin layer of oil on top of the water. And so this is an important piece of vocabulary also for today's fun fact. But let's go ahead and listen to that joke again to see if it makes a little bit more sense. What do you call a victim of an urban oil spill? A city slicker. All right, let's go ahead and begin with the expression of the day, which is spill the beans. To spill the beans means to ruin a surprise or an event by informing others prematurely. Oftentimes when we say someone spills the beans, it means that they share a secret, right? Something that shouldn't be told. So let's go through the individual words of the expression, and then I'll give you some examples to make more sense of it. So spill is a verb that means to let something fall or pour out. Usually when something spills, it is unintentional, not on purpose. We usually spill the contents of a cup, for example, coffee or milk or water. And when liquid spills out of the cup, it can land on the table, on the floor. Yesterday, I accidentally knocked over a giant glass of water. In other words, I spilled a giant glass of water and the water spilled out onto my lap and landed on my shoes. What a mess. The is a definitive article. In beans, well, a bean is a seed of a plant in the legume family. There are many different types of beans: kidney beans, lima beans, pinto beans, refried beans, black beans, green beans, coffee beans, and this is just to name a few of them. So once again, the expression to spill the beans means to ruin a surprise by informing others prematurely or simply just sharing a secret, right? That shouldn't be told. So if I say, who spilled the beans? It could mean who shared the secret or who shared the information prematurely? Who revealed it? Who gave it away? So where does this expression come from? There seems to be a consensus online when it comes to this expression's origin. As you probably know, democracy dates back to ancient Greece. Everyone had a say in elections. In other words, everyone had a vote. And to vote, each individual would receive a white bean and a black bean. The white bean meant pro, for, or yes, and the black bean signified contra, against, or simply no. To cast a vote a certain way, they would place a bean in its respective jar. Before counting the votes, people warned against spilling the beans. Don't spill the beans, otherwise you will reveal the final result prematurely. Okay, kind of a fun background story to this expression, right? So let's go through some examples to make more sense of this expression and how we would use it in kind of normal situations. Example number one, imagine you go to a surprise birthday party and the birthday boy or birthday girl doesn't seem so surprised when they walk through the front door. You might hear someone say, someone must have spilled the beans. In other words, someone must have shared the secret that there was going to be a surprise birthday party. Otherwise, they would look surprised, right? They don't seem surprised. Okay, example number two. Imagine you're in high school and you tell a friend that you want to apply to drama school and become an actor instead of going to a regular four-year college. And you ask your friend to please keep your secret. When you get home, however, your parents sit you down and start talking to you about your future plans, emphasizing how important it is to think carefully about this life-changing decision. Why this discussion all of a sudden, you think to yourself? You get the impression that your friend spilled the beans. You think he or she shared your secret to your parents. You might want to call that friend and say, hey, did you spill the beans? In other words, did you share my secret? Example number three. This is a personal example. So in the United States, it's very common to wait until after week 13 of a pregnancy to tell people that you're pregnant. And the reason for that is that so many things can go wrong during the first trimester. So you want to keep it on the down low. You want to keep it hush hush, right? So I only told my parents about my pregnancy, my parents-in-law, and Lucas, my husband. And I told them, you guys need to keep a secret. Don't tell anyone. But within a week, I received multiple messages from Lucas's cousins in Brazil, a really upset message from my aunt who had found out from my sister-in-law's aunt that I was pregnant, and the list goes on. I thought to myself at the time, how the heck do all of these people know my news? Lucas must have spilled the beans. Both of our parents must have spilled the beans. And it turned out everyone spilled the beans. In other words, everyone shared the secret prematurely, all right? Which ended up being fine because the baby was healthy. But I know for next time that if I want to keep a secret, I just shouldn't tell anyone. Let's go ahead and do some pronunciation exercises. We'll use the phrase, who spilled the beans? In other words, who shared the secret prematurely? Repeat after me. Who? Who spilled? Who spilled the? Who spilled the beans? Who spilled the beans? Who spilled the beans? I could have also said spilt here. Spilt, spilt. S-P-I-L-T instead of S-P-I-L-L-E-D. In American English, you can say either spilled or spilt. Both of those are acceptable. Okay, let's go through the conjugation. Repeat after me. I spilled the beans. You spilled the beans. He spilled the beans. She spilled the beans. We spilled the beans. They spilled the beans. It spilled the beans. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the topic of the day, oil spills. And I apologize in advance for the amount of detail I'm going to go into about this topic. It's intentional, and it's because I found this topic very interesting. So by the end of this, you really should feel very confident when talking about oil spills, the vocabulary needed to talk about them, and also about the United States regulations when it comes to offshore drilling. So I hope you find it as interesting as I do. Today we'll be talking about three of the biggest oil spills in US waters. And I'd like to start with a story. In 2007, I started school at UCSB, the University of California, Santa Barbara. The first days were surreal. It was the first time living outside of my parents' home, and my dorm room was just walking distance from the ocean. I was in Isla Vista, a party city on the beach, only filled with college-age students. The first night down there, a big group of people from my dorm wandered the streets and ended up at a place called Sands Beach. We walked barefoot in the sand, watching the surfers coming out of the water. And about 3 miles out, we could see what looked like a cruise ship with twinkly lights. Someone commented in the group that it was an oil rig, not a cruise ship. An oil rig is a structure which has the main purpose to drill oil from an oil well or a hole in the ground from which oil comes. So we walked back up to Isla Vista, and under the streetlights, we could see big blobs of sticky black stuff on our feet. It seemed like tar or oil, and whatever it wasn't coming off. So we all learned shortly afterwards that our romantic-looking cruise ship was in fact an oil rig and part of a massive environmental debate about drilling on the California coast. And that nasty black stuff on our feet, well, it was oil. Perhaps it was from the natural seep near the coal oil reserve, but it might have also been part of the Santa Barbara oil spill, which took place in 1969 and was considered the biggest environmental disaster the U.S. had experienced at that time. Santa Barbara is the first story I'd like to tell. Today, it is considered the third, or fourth, debatably, largest oil spill in U.S. offshore drilling, just behind the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska in 1989 and the Deep Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Now, the spills occurred for a variety of different reasons, and they were dealt with in a variety of different ways, which we'll talk about now. The consequences, however, were similar, of course, on different scales. Let's start with Santa Barbara. First, it's probably important to mention that Santa Barbara and the Channel Islands, just a few miles from Santa Barbara shore, are home to an array of sea life. Many species of fish and sea creatures only exist in these unique ecosystems. Santa Barbara's residents care deeply about their beaches, the natural habitats of the species there, as you'll see in their protected monarch butterfly groves and their snowy plover habitats, and volunteer organizations to keep everything clean. So even back then, the area was very environmentally conscious. So you can imagine their shock and disapproval when oil geologists began exploring potential for offshore drilling along the coast in the early 60s. Summerland, a city just south of Santa Barbara, was home to the first offshore drilling site in the world, according to the California Department of Conservation, and that was built in 1896. The thick, oil-filled sedimentary rock lay just 200 feet below the water surface, which made it perfect for the available drilling technology at that time. A lot of the oil companies wanted to get in on the success of Summerland, and so they fought for leases on the oil rigs in and around Santa Barbara. And one of the companies that got a lease was Union Oil. On January 28, 1969, employees from Union Oil were drilling when oil and mud started spewing out from their well. The crew members tried to act quickly to stop the flow, first by attempting to put a cap or a lid on the crude oil that emerged. But the pressure was too strong and they couldn't do it with their manpower. So an emergency measure was required. They jammed a drill, which was about 800 meters long, back into the hole and slammed two giant steel blocks over it so that no oil could escape. And it took about 13 minutes of struggling for the spillage to finally stop. Yet, the whole problem wasn't over. The problem had a domino effect. The pressure from below the ocean floor was so great that the oil broke through the seabed. Right? The seabed is another word for ocean floor. And in multiple other locations, oil emerged, right? Some nearby and some at a distance. So there was no feasible way for these men to plug the holes immediately. In just 24 hours, the spill had covered 75 square miles, and over a period of 1 week, 210,000 gallons of oil spilled. There was a storm that week too, and the ocean currents and winds carried the oil along the water and along the coast. So boats in the harbor were covered in oil, seabirds lay dead along the beaches, dolphins and seals and many other animals, uncountable, had died. So eventually, with mud and concrete, leaks in the ocean floor or in its seabed were plugged. But the tragic disaster is still being dealt with today. So some of the good things that came out of this, of course, there's always got to be some good in such a horrible disaster. Well, the Clean Water Act was born, and also the Environmental Protection Agency was created alongside a lot of other environmental legislation. Now let's go ahead and talk about Exxon Valdez. Well, this happened not while drilling, but while transporting oil in an oil tanker in Alaska's Prince William Sound. On March 24th, 1989, the tanker rammed into a reef. And a reef is this sort of underwater ridge of either coral, it can be rock or sand, and it crushed the front of the tanker, allowing approximately 11 million gallons to spill into the scenic territory. And disaster is a word that's a bit of an understatement for this spill because of everything that happened afterwards and for the story of what happened before this disaster. First of all, the response to the cleanup was slower than expected. The location was hard to get to, so only 10% of the oil was collected after 24 hours. Apparently, the chemicals dropped on the area hadn't been tested to evaluate whether they were toxic, and helicopters dropped them heavily on the marine area. Journalists later wrote that some of the elements in the fluid were responsible for the lung, kidney, and blood disorders among the cleanup crew. Also, in the rocky coves, or these caves, that collected a lot of oil, a lot of hot water at a very high pressure was sprayed against the wall, killing microorganisms that provide food for the sea life in the region. Scientific studies at a later point in time revealed that these microorganisms actually help biodegrade oil, that they actually help in oil cleanup. As many as 250,000 birds died soon after, 2,800 otters, 250 bald eagles, right, the national bird of the United States, and many more sea creatures, including many salmon and herring, which are two of the most popular fished fish in the area. It all sounds very horrible, but how does a giant tanker just crash into a reef? Doesn't it seem a little bit strange? So this is the story that got a lot of news coverage back in 1989 and also into the 90s, partially because the story was sensational. Exxon heavily blamed the captain of the boat, Joseph Hazelwood, who was apparently drunk at the time and not at the controls when the boat hit the reef. He put his third mate in charge. If that's not bad enough, on top of that, the radar system to ensure that nothing could be hit had been broken for 1 year at that point in time. So there was no way for them to know what was underneath the water. And it was an area with a lot of icebergs too. The tanker was off its normal route because they believed they would run into small icebergs. The crew also blamed Exxon. They said that they had been working 12 to 14 hour shifts plus overtime and that everyone was exhausted. They also were angry that the advanced technology they had been promised for detecting icebergs wasn't ever delivered to them. So who's really responsible for this disaster? Well, you can make your own decision on that. From my personal point of view, as irresponsible as it is for one person, especially a captain, to be drunk and not at the controls, I don't think a tanker with as much oil as it had should ever be the responsibility of one individual, from my personal opinion. There should be many checks and balances in place, both by the company and maybe even by the government, to make sure such a potential disaster won't happen. In any case, Joseph Hazelwood received a misdemeanor, fined $50,000, and sentenced to 1,000 hours of community service. All right, let's move on to the last oil spill, the Deep Horizon spill. This is the largest marine oil spill ever recorded. The disaster began on April 20th, 2010, on the Deepwater Horizon rig that was being leased by BP in the Gulf of Mexico, about 41 miles south of Louisiana. The drill was about 5,000 feet below the water and another 18,000 feet into the rock. Very, very, very deep. That's when there was a sudden gush of natural gas from within the well. A gush is when a lot of water or liquid moves at once. And so the pressure was so strong that it broke the concrete seal that was on top of it and shot up the casing onto the oil rig, which caught fire. And then 2 days later, it sank beneath the water's surface. However, the damage was done. Oil poured into the Gulf and continued to spill until September, right? That's about 5 months later. When the oil leak slowed, concrete could be pumped into the well and seal it off. So the estimated amount of oil spilled in the bay was recorded at 4.9 million barrels, which is equivalent to about 210 million gallons or about 795 million liters. And in effect, it's considered the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. So what's the aftermath of this event? Well, the Deepwater Horizon spill killed 11 people or 11 crew members working on board the rig. BP was accused of manslaughter, right? Manslaughter is similar to murder, except it's when there is not an intent to kill. So BP was also accused of numerous other damages and needed to pay $65 billion for those. The adverse environmental impact is still being determined, but up until about 2014, the water was still being skimmed for excess oil, right? So that slick was still being removed. Studies have been done at Stanford and collaborative groups of professors from Australia and the United States, which have confirmed that the solvents used in chemicals to disperse the oil, which were also the same ones used in Alaska, cause heart mutations. And so, as you probably may know, fishing in the Gulf is very popular, and one third of the fishing was shut down due to lack of information about the safety of the fish. In 2012, these complaints were still surfacing. Right. According to Dr. Jim Cohen from the Louisiana State University, the fishermen had never seen anything like the mutations before. It was said that about 50% of the shrimp caught in the area had no eyes. Oof. There's nothing really positive about an oil spill. It's a mess to clean up and a mess to deal with even years after it happens. So you might be wondering who makes the decisions when it comes to offshore drilling. Now, this is really interesting if you want to have a discussion with anybody about offshore drilling in the United States. So there is a law that every state on the coast owns 3 nautical miles from the shore. That's 5.6 kilometers. And therefore, they have the right to decide whether they will lease that territory or not for offshore drilling. That means if I'm 2 miles out in the ocean, I'm still in California and under California's jurisdiction. There are a few exceptions to this rule. For example, Texas and Florida that own 9 nautical miles or 16.7 kilometers from the shoreline. And Louisiana, which is, I think, a little bit less than average. Past state waters and still within U.S. territory is considered federal water. And the government can decide whether they want to drill for more oil there. The U.S. government leases rigs to companies who pay them rent per month and also royalties on gas. Last year, royalties were approximately 18% of the revenue earned by these oil rigs. So if you really think about it, they're earning a ton of money. That's a lot of money earned by these oil rigs. So when you're trying to understand the government's point of view versus the state's point of view on the matters of drilling, offshore drilling, it's important to see how much money they actually earn from it. Thank you for listening to this episode of the American English Podcast. Remember, it's my goal here to not only help you improve your listening comprehension, but to show you how to speak like someone from the States. If you want to receive the full transcript for this episode, or you just want to support this podcast, make sure to sign up to premium content on AmericanEnglishPodcast.com. Thanks and hope to see you soon. I also have an announcement. Two of my very good friends who are also English teachers and podcasters, Dana Clemenson and Pete Smithson, also posted an episode this week on the expression spill the beans. And their episode is in the same format as this one. So if you'd like to work on your Canadian pronunciation, your Australian pronunciation, or even if you just want to listen to a fun fact about either of their countries, Australia or Canada, then check out their podcasts. You can find them in your podcast player, whichever podcast app that you're listening to, and also on their websites at canlearnenglish.com and aussieenglish.com.au. They'll both be posting their episode on Friday, August 23rd. So, as of tomorrow. I'm curious to know what you think.